Hello, this is a show from Radio. We're a group of stations bringing new and forgotten ways of making radio to our listeners.
Delta 2 Yankee, Juliet Romeo.
Each week we give artists the challenge to make radio that works across the whole of Europe and beyond.
Delta 2 Yankee, Delta 2 Yankee, Juliet Romeo.
Are you up for it?
Good afternoon, ladies, gentlemen, and other species. We are Koolhaven from Rotterdam, and we are here at the Dartington Center, guests for Sound Art Radio. And we present here our project, The Shadow Side of Sound, in which we are investigating unknown and or forgotten composers from our hometown, Rotterdam, in Holland. We just listened to Monique, a piece by Gerarda Evenbeen, one of the composers in our project. We will concentrate on another composer called Julie Bruins-Rampart. She was born in 1922 and died in 2005. So far we found some material of her and reinterpreted some pieces of her, and recently discovered that she had two daughters, which from the beginning lived with their father in England. Sibyl and Plasma Heart are here in the studio, and we're going to talk about their mother, Julie Bruins-Rampart. Short introduction on Julie Bruins-Rampart. In her free evening hours, Julie Bruins-Rampart composed lustily. Her favorite instrument was the great Baroque flute. We see this instrument in most of her compositions, sometimes solo, but often in combination with other instrumentation. And what makes Bruins-Rampart's work attractive are the often complex gesticular additions that her work contains. She often stages the performances in a tableau vivant and doesn't shy away from acting unorthodox. Her work was dismissed as amateurish, amusical, and immoral. Sibyl and Plasma, we're happy to have you here in the studio.
Yes, thank you. Thanks for inviting us in. Yeah.
Yes, it's an honour to speak to you. It's really an honor.
Can I add something to your introduction? Because we are investigating your mother. In the beginning, it looked like the Baroque flute had a big influence. But then later on, we found lots of other recordings and other stuff. And you might also tell us about that. And there's no Baroque flute at all there. So I just wanted to add that. So can you tell us about how you discovered that Julie Rampart was your mother? Or did you always know that? I heard that you never met her, really. Except for being born and...
That's right, yeah. Yes.
Didn't really miss her because our father gave us everything we needed, really. So there wasn't really a lack of parents for us, was there?
No, we never felt that. And I think as twins as well, we felt like a complete family, really, didn't we, with that?
Definitely, yes, we did, yeah.
Did your father remarry or something?
No, but he was a musician too, so he was always immersed in his music and the community, you know, meeting with other people.
He was really happy.
Music and In fact, it's his 100th birthday this year, so he's still...
Yeah. Whoa, so he's still alive?
He's alive.
Yeah,
he is.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we're celebrating.
Not quite how he was, but he can still play a little bit of music and,
But he was exactly as old as your mother then.
Yeah, so both born in 1922.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hmm. Was your mother mentioned by your father, or was she never in sight in that sense?
I think I do remember, but it just felt so not important. It's funny. We never really questioned or asked him much about her. So it wasn't a big secret. It wasn't like something covered up.
No, absolutely.
It just did not feel relevant to us until... Mm. Really, until very recently, when we started to take an interest. And as you know, she's a composer who's really been quite neglected and misunderstood. Mm. So it's only very recently, since when she died, that we started to take an interest in her and then start to actually think, yes, this is quite important to us and to who we are.
Because although we had such a I was going to say panoply, I'm not sure if that's the word I mean, but such a panoply of characters around us and mentioned to us from different parts of our father's life and from our lives, we didn't really miss...
No.
But she was... He'd say the odd thing that I just accepted and...
But you've got to see, like, he was in a phase of her life that was quite different, I think, and that's... So, you know, we didn't really have characters around her that you would actually think were like her, but that's because we came from a very specific interest and specific kind of part of her life. So the other things that you might know that she went on to do, they're quite a different world, quite a different musical world than that.
So your father always had been a musician, so that was maybe also part of their relationship.
So she came to England because she was studying, before the Baroque flute, she was studying recorders, so end-blown flutes, and also a little bit of the bagpipes. So she was interested in these medieval instruments, and that's what that was our dad's thing too. So he's really passionate, isn't he? Medieval music, early music.
Did she study here in Dartington?
Yeah, she came here to study some early music, and that was how they met. So it was a very different part of her life. And then, from what we understand, so, as you know, when she died, it was probably about 6 months after she died. We read that she died, and we're like, oh, we read that this person died, but we still didn't think that much of it, and we didn't go to the Netherlands or anything. And then we had some post, which was very interesting, with some
Not emails, actual, parcel,
diaries and stuff in the post. And then and we looked at them, and oh, that's quite interesting. And then a few months after that, we had another, a huge parcel, absolutely enormous, which we're still going through. We couldn't believe it, with stacks and stacks of papers, like half-written scores, sketchbooks, all those sketchbooks with little drawings in, and
travel,
some of them quite shocking. Journals from travels, all her diaries.
Quite shocking, you say?
Some of the drawings are, I won't talk about now, but... started to piece together that
and I some charcoal sketches that you
some quite big ones. They were folded up unfortunately, so they don't look that good. They're a bit messy when you open
smudged.
Them up
and for your father, it was also clearly that after you and your father left Julie Brown's, that her life went into a completely different direction than he knew before from her, or
Yes, and I think what I'm starting... So she was part of this movement, really, in the Netherlands, which was a sort of art and political movement, but that looked at sadomasochism. And from what we're piecing together, I believe that before we were born, she had these interests, but they were very personal. They were about the body. They were, you know, they were personal experiences. And when she became pregnant by our father, he didn't know. So that they weren't together very long. And when she was back in the Netherlands and she realised, this is from notes in diaries, she challenged herself to go ahead, go through the birth of twins, because she wanted that physical experience. She thought it would be extreme and maybe liberating, transformative physical experience. But she didn't really think about babies or
children. She didn't want it sanitized either. She wanted
it painful as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she went through this
experience.
And then realized, of course, then she actually had two babies that they were real people with real needs, and that she drew a line and she said to Dad, you know, this is where we're at.
She bandaged her chest in a kind of a medieval sort of fashion. She didn't want to
feed us.
But what seemed to happen around then was that then from then on, she was able to channel all that interest in the pain and in the body out of her physical body into her music. So the music before then was, was, you know, much more polite. She was looking at these, she was doing songwriting, writing song cycles about landscapes. She was using motifs from, you know, in modes from early music and exploring all kinds of instruments. After we were born, she really took a different direction, and it seemed that rather than these two very separate worlds, you know, I write some very nice music, but I have this personal interest in other things, they somehow came together and the music took on those qualities.
Quite shortly after you were born, the separation was set already. Did you find any notes of this process you went through in looking for this ultimate pain, so to say? You just described you found it in notes, or
there
is
was
it
an essay, quite a well composed essay that she
a
just
bit like a manifesto.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Can you?
It was typed. We had some sort of yellowy kind of. Paper because you know this was
isn't it called it's called a body of music.
We saw that in,
okay, you have seen that. Yeah,
we have seen some of the
it
material of course,
but it was the only most of her writing that was published in a very small like a feminist magazine at the time in the Netherlands. So
we actually there's somebody quite local to us who's been really helpful to us as an interpreter, and he's helped us to decipher. And it's kind of made us we've had to become more intimate with this person because the things were so kind of personal, but impersonal, weren't they? The things that we found in.
I myself, I'm from the punk generation, so I was 16 in 1979. 1977, I have to say. And I know that at a certain point you had this band from Rotterdam called Tandsticker Shocks, and Julie, she met them. She was already in her 50s then. They inspired her to write some kind of, you could say now, punkish compositions. Of course, she hated the male voice, so she kind of, one thing she did, she forbid them to sing. I know one of those band members, I still know him, he's called Pinkel, and he told me that. And also, she didn't like the stupid rock kind of thing, but she loved the sound and the melodies of the guitars. So she kind of, very short, I think they only worked together for a few months because she asked a lot from the musicians and they were really simple.
But didn't they do a bagpipe piece together as well? Didn't they do a piece where
no.
she played the bagpipes?
No, maybe where she played the bagpipes.
She played the
bagpipes. Yeah, together. But
you found material?
Do you have that, maybe?
Don't have a recording, no.
Okay.
No. Because I have the recordings of the kind of punkish stuff. I can play like a very short one.
It's interesting that you mentioned the bagpipes because also there the tonal settings remind a bit of how she used to compose the patterns of the guitars. Eh? They all play together, but at the same time they are shifting constantly, which was a bit in the air in that time also. At other composers and contemporary punk-like, more abstract musicians, which became even famous afterwards for that kind of music. But Julie was much more ahead of that time.
Yeah, maybe it was a kind of an accident. So she met those guys and she could let them play this kind of music. She was slightly sadistic about it because she wrote stuff for them, not in notes, but in letters. That made it really, on one hand, easy to play, but some of the songs were really long and they really had to concentrate a lot. It was slightly sadistic.
She wrote quite some of these compositions on cardboard of wrapping up cookies.
Mm-hmm.
In certain forms. Eh?
In certain forms, yeah. I think there, yes. I found one notation that she called them the dick compositions. Mm-hmm. So it was a sort of offensive thing, probably also by confronting these guys.
Yeah, they were punk guys, you know, like she confronted them with their own genitals, you could say. I'll just play one short piece.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, here it comes. Yeah, that's it.
Mm-hmm. Sort of deranged harpsichord kind of quality, hasn't it?
It has, yes. Yeah.
We did find a cipher or two. We found a diagram with points. So I thought it reminded me of something to do with acupuncture or some kind of medical sort of picture.
Yeah, I think it was a score.
It was exactly
Are you hearing this for the first time, or did you already have those? Because we found it on a broken down cassette, so it's not the best quality of sound.
That second box has some cassettes in, but we haven't gone through them all yet.
A friend suggested that she'd used an 8-track, that she'd used samples, that she'd sort of collaged it together.
You have all this material for a long time, but did we kind of stress you up by asking suddenly about it? Because you nobody.
It's still sitting there.
I feel ashamed, actually, that I haven't. I know so little now. But then, how could we? You know, we have our own lives. But I'd like to.
I think this is the thing when you get a big box. It's a bit. You know, we did. There's things we did immediately.
Yeah.
And then there's things that just kind of got put off and put off, really. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. How does her work relate to your what you are doing yourself in your lives nowadays, professionally or not professionally? Like, do you recognize her obsession or her love for music? Because she did music for all her life, you could say. Are you in this business as well?
Not in any commercial sense, but I had this funny experience when I was a child that I wanted to learn the recorder, and I really wanted a plastic, one of those plastic recorders, dark brown, and my dad laughed. And
because he had to have the best, the proper one.
And he saw it was important to me to be like the other children, and he got us each a little plastic one. But I see the value of the
But you're very good. You play all the recorders, like the tenor and the bass. We have a bass recorder. Still very good on the recorder. I think. I mean, I find, and the more we looked at, you know, some of these experiences of hers and the notes and things, is I think I, even though we were saying like we just sort of didn't really talk about her, but I used to have these dreams growing up with, like, and they were like music dreams, and I now think it was her music I was hearing in the dreams, because it wasn't like the music we were around here at all. You know, it was a really different sound world, and so the more I look into it and the things I have kind of heard and read about. And
The whale drone, the dream that you had with the whales and the drones, and that we thought it might a bagpipe kind of.
Yeah, because they kind of metamorph, you know, across the piece. So you start with this very low kind of like. And you're not sure if you're awake or asleep or if it's or like a buzz in the room.
It could be an electronic.
And then it's like you're under the sea.
Yeah.
And then it kind of became like a bagpipe playing, and it sort of builds up. And then there is this sort of guitar thing that kind of comes out of that. And then just as you start to actually really hear it, it kind of goes... And then you can hardly remember it at all.
Yeah.
And the only reason I can remember it is because I dreamt it so many times. Yeah. But, you know, it's kind of like evaporates. The music kind of evaporates.
Yeah.
But does this music really exist or just in your dream?
I feel it was a dream, a connection to her. Just a sort of parallel sort of... Mm. Because it was a reoccurring dream from when I was about... Yeah. I think about 8 years old, which would have been in 77.
Yeah.
So I started to dream these sounds. And then I did start to experience them, for example, when the supermarket or something, when the air conditioning's on, it would start to go into this kind of... And then this sort of like these other sounds would come into that, like people's voices or the dings on the checkout, and it would start to have the same experience again of like... these drones building up and then the kind of the clang of these guitars coming in and then you walk out of the door and pff. Back at the time, I didn't think, oh, this is my lost Dutch composer mother getting in touch. It was just how I experienced life. And to be honest, as a child, I didn't know that other people didn't experience life like that in the supermarket, like the music of the supermarket, air conditioning, or whatever. I thought that was
probably
just what it was.
Not even accepting or interpreting it as music, but just as
a life, like
life,
yeah,
life,
yeah, yeah. But I could kind of enjoy it. It's more like, oh, this is a bit. This is a bit where this happens, and then it gets louder, and now it's kind of built into a sort of rhythm, and then it kind of this sort of vanishes.
And there was that time, the one time that I do you remember when we had the same dream, and I think that I heard. So I don't know whether I was here. What you. Thank you. But that just that one time that when we were, because we shared a room as children, and then we haven't shared a room much since then. But there's been times when we've been in the same space for, and we once had a dream, and I dreamt the music too.
And but then we did that. We made that record piece. Do you remember? And we went because we were learning recorder at school that everybody did, and everybody played things like, you know, Forever Jacker or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then we came in and we said, oh, we've written a song on our recorders. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, you can play it to the class. And then when we came in to play our piece, it was like... we were really like enjoying it. We were like blowing away overblowing them and like this big thing, building up all these layers of the sound and blowing, taking the end off and blowing through that. And they were like... and then the teacher just said something like... Yeah. Well, thank you, Sybil and Plesma, but that's not really playing the recorder.
Bill was quite insistent that it was.
We found a score and used a little bit of modern technology to play it, but it's really her text. Mm-hmm. And it's against how you say this, male macho stuff. Mm-hmm. So let's. Shall I play it?
Yes, please.
Yeah.
It's more abstract, and I think it must be from the 80s. We're not sure. From
Blick voll auf Reisende Welten.